Richard Kemble. The destination, Death Row State Prison. The irony, Richard Kemble is innocent. Proved guilty, what Richard Kemble could not prove was that moments before discovering his murdered wife's body, he saw a one-armed man running from the vicinity of his home. Richard Kemble ponders his fate as he looks at the world for the last time and sees only darkness. But in that darkness, fate moves its huge hand.
The Fugitive!
A QM production, starring David Jansen as The Fugitive. Also starring Barry Morse as Lieutenant Gerard.
And after several weeks of absence, we're back once again with Talking Fugitive on KSAV.org with the regular suspects, Bobby, Kitty, and Ken. So, gang, welcome back.
Hi, thanks.
Okay. Are we ready to go?
Yeah, go for it, Bob.
Okay. All right. When Richard Kemble disembarks from a bus in Tucson, Arizona, September 17, 1963, to begin the televised portion of his cross-country search for the one-armed man he believed may have murdered his wife, he is guaranteed of only one thing, that his search will probably last at least 13 weeks, because that's the amount of time that networks gave a new TV series to create an audience big enough to keep it on the air. There was no reason to be very optimistic beyond that, because series creator Roy Huggins had shopped his series idea around considerably and been told by just about everyone in the TV business that it was a terrible idea and would never sell. Even he was beginning to have doubts. But then the ABC TV network, because of their dismal ratings, decides to take a chance on it. And to perhaps the surprise of many, the series is an instant hit. By the time it reaches that 13th episode, it has presented two classic stories, Never Wave Goodbye and Nightmare at North Oak. Much of the country is captivated over this story of one man chasing another, and as the old saying goes, the rest is history. Flash forward 3 years to September of 1966, and The Fugitive has 90 episodes in the can. Unfortunately, David Jansen, the star of the show, is also in the can. He has appeared in nearly every scene of those 90 episodes, and by this time, it has taken a terrible toll. He is exhausted, and his health is declining. He tells executive producer Quinn Martin that he wishes to end the series and his participation in it after the fourth season. Urged by Martin to think it over before making a final decision, he does that, and after wavering over this for some time, he finally decides he has indeed had enough. He tells TV Guide in an interview, quote, "They made me an offer. It would have been worth maybe $500,000 to me. Then I decided against the fifth year. I think I would have fallen apart if I hadn't." And so Quinn Martin decides they will do a series-ending episode and make TV history. In his original treatment, creator Roy Huggins had written, quote, "This will be a series with a planned conclusion, that conclusion being, of course, Richard Kimball's release from his predicament and the ultimate salvation of justice." But Huggins never bothered to write that conclusion or even suggest in an outline what it should look like. So producer Martin first has to find someone to write it. According to Ed Robertson in The Fugitive Recaptured, Martin's first choice was writer Don Brinkley, who had written about a half dozen prior episodes for the series, including Memorable Stories, Near Classics, Wings of an Angel, and Running Scared, and an all-time classic, May God Have Mercy, an episode on just about everyone's best of list. Unfortunately, he was not available to write the finale. Had he been, the series finale and the shows we are about to do might look and sound a lot different. Instead, Martin taps his longtime associate producer, George Eckstein, who had left the series and then was persuaded to return for season four. During his tenure, Eckstein wrote a wide variety of stories, some good, like The Survivors and See Hollywood and Die, and some truly awful, like Last Second of a Big Dream, but no real classics. However, he may be best remembered for writing the infamous next-to-last episode of Season 1, Storm Center, a story on just about everyone's worst of list. By the way, that sound you just heard was Ken falling off his chair. Quinn also assigns Eckstein a co-writer named Michael Zager, who has never written for The Fugitive. He is best known for his writing contributions on the very popular medical series of that era, Ben Casey. And so it is announced that The Fugitive will make TV history with a two-part concluding episode at the end of the summer of 1967. That sets off a months-long frenzy of speculation over just how it will all end. Will Kimble really be exonerated, or are we in for a surprise when he unscrews his fake arm and walks off into the sunset, revealing himself as the real killer? Even in Las Vegas, the bookmakers are taking bets. And so we find ourselves then and now at a two-part episode called The Judgment. That title alone should tell you that this will indeed be a conclusion. But can it possibly live up to the hype around it? Will it stay true to the series and its preceding 118 episodes? Is this the classic story to end all classic stories? Over the next several months, we will be taking an open-ended, microscopic look at these episodes, much like we did the past month at The Fugitive Views and Reviews. And of course, we will end with our views of how it should have looked. So let us begin at the beginning, at the start of The Judgment, Part 1. Police officers are rushing into a topless bar in Los Angeles, where a badly beaten and bloodied bartender is shakily pouring himself a drink. We also see that the place has been completely wrecked. He points the officers to a back door, and when they emerge from it, we see a man hovering over another man, who is also beaten and on the ground. The first man is brandishing a knife and waving it back and forth in his face. The cops order him up against the wall, and he turns around, and to our shock, it's none other than Fred Johnson, the infamous one-armed man. I say we are shocked, or at least I am, because if I'm correct, this is the only time that the one-armed man is seen to start an episode, and other than in a clean and quiet town where he attempts to beat up Kimble, he's generally never shown as being particularly violent. Usually he's just been seen by Kimble, and he's scared and starts running away. Now it appears he may well have a murderous instinct in him after all. Ken, aren't you just a little surprised to see Johnson this way so fast?
Well, in my opinion, Bob, The Judgment Part 1, when it begins, it started off poorly. The first scene should immediately remind the audience what this series is all about.
Even before this?
Yes.
Really?
The first scene should have had Kimble pulling over at a rest stop, taking a nap, and dreaming about his lovely wife, Helen Kimble.
Wow.
For at least 2 or 3 minutes, you know, in good times. Remind the audience what's going on. Richard and Helen were married. She's killed. Kimball's on the run. And then, you know, just give the audience the taste of Helen Kimble. We haven't seen her in so long. I mean, when was the last time we saw her? Season 2?
No, season 1.
I think it was season 2. We saw her in Escape into Black. The Kimble had a little flashback. And
no.
He saw her on the ground. But yeah, you're right. Way back in season 1, we saw her in Egypt. But Bob, that's the way I would have started the episode. But you're saying when they started it off with Fred Johnson, you know, in the bar there, and then the police arrest him.
Yeah, well, I find it a little unusual because I don't know whether they were really thinking this or not, but it seems to me that even though the narrator has already told us at the beginning that Johnson did indeed do it, so forth and so on, that they wanted to create just a tiny, tiny little bit of doubt in people's minds because we never see him particularly be violent. So, you know, it leaves just a little bit of doubt. I mean, Kitty, you and I discussed on a recent show that in the second Fugitive, F2 as we call it, they did indeed have a one-armed man who was violent and killed other people, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But in this case, I don't really, you know, the beginning of this really didn't bother me. You know, it's basically kind, even though, as I've said before, they set it up very cleverly with the narrator saying that Kimble saw a one-armed man running out of his house. The narrator never actually tells us that the one-armed man killed Helen. We're just left to believe it.
Well, that's true. And actually, Kimble is really assuming that he's responsible. I mean,
exactly.
Just because a man runs in front of your car doesn't mean he's the perpetrator of the crime.
Right, except in that episode from season 3, Wife Killer, when he asked him point blank if he killed his wife, and he nodded affirmatively that he did. So that kind of removed the doubt there.
Right.
So if you look at it from that viewpoint, obviously he had to have a violent side because, you know, why else would Helen be dead? You know, so, and like I, you know, and as you pointed out, in a clean and quiet town, he did confront Kimball and try to have a physical altercation with him, and Kimball got the upper hand in that.
What do you think of Ken's idea? I mean, it's not a bad idea, but the producers would have had to have started this a lot earlier. There's no way you do that in 2 episodes.
Well, I think that, I don't know, it's maybe a little too little too late. I mean, I would have liked to have seen flashbacks of Helen in a more likable light in other episodes, so that, you know, so that by the time we got to this episode, it, you know, it would certainly be evident in everybody's mind that, you know, that this is about Kimball, who's on the run, and his wife was killed. But by the same token, you know, Kimball never really talks about his wife. He never even hardly ever addresses her by name, you know, and you know, and as we've pointed out repeatedly, he never really seems to be that upset that she's dead. Just
well,
he got blamed for it.
You know, somebody's got to write it in order for a character to say it.
Right.
And nobody ever writes it, and that's the problem. Let's move on to this scene after this, and we see the one-armed man be terribly violent, and he's obviously being arrested. In the next scene, Kimball has got a new job as usual, and what do you know, he's back in Tucson, Arizona, where everything began. I kind of like that. It's a little tip of a hat to the origins of this series. Unfortunately, that's the only time in this two-part story that the writers will remember anything that happened before.
And, you know, chances are, Bob, I think that might have just been a coincidence.
That's quite a coincidence if it is.
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, just because he wasn't in Tucson for very long.
Well, we'll see. I don't know about that. But anyway, so we see him. He's working for a trucking company fixing trucks, and his boss sends him to fix a particular truck. When he gets in the truck, he sees a newspaper sitting there with a picture of Fred Johnson on it and an article about how a man with one arm wrecked a bar. And we assume that he's going to probably head for L.A. But we don't see that right away. And the next scene takes place at L.A. police headquarters. In the lobby of the building, before we get there, at the beginning, there's a young reporter walking out of an office with a police captain, and he's talking about this incident with the arrest of a one-armed man. And it appears that the captain is trying to talk him into running this as a story, a national story in a newspaper, and he's saying to him, are you making a big deal out of this? This is just one guy who wrecked a bar. This doesn't have any real national interest. Nevertheless, he kind of doesn't say that he will or he won't. It's kind of left up in the air, and they part outside the office. Then the police captain walks back in, and what do you know, Gerard is already in there. So this episode wastes no time in bringing all of the characters together quickly. Gerard is already there, and we find out when they're having a conversation that they're setting a trap for Kimball, that they've got a one-armed man, and they hope to put it in the paper, that Kimball will see it, and then he will come to L.A. looking for the one-armed man. I don't know whether this is a good idea or not, but I will say this. How come Gerard didn't do this a long time ago? This is the first instance here that we can think back to Wife Killer, where Gerard had the one-armed man right in his clutches, and he was even injured. And even though Barbara Webb was telling him, talk to the one-armed man, he said, we'll talk to him later. So, I mean, you know, and by that time he had escaped. So Gerard now simply is setting it up. It took him 4 years to come up with this plan. What do you think about this, Ken? You like this plan of trying to smoke Kimball out?
No, I didn't like the beginning again. I have other suggestions, Bob. You know, Kimball's working for a trucking company. I thought that was a mistake. They should have had Kimball in the hospital working as an orderly. remind us at, you know, the hospital and, you know.
Well, he did that. He did that in May God Have Mercy.
Right. I would have done that.
Right.
And then another thing I would have done with Gerard is instead of just having him show up and he's right there on the scene, I would have had him in Captain Carpenter's office, and the two are discussing, and Carpenter's almost had it, and Gerard says, I think I've almost got him, and, you know, you kind of give a little teaser. So I would have done that. But as far as setting a trap, you know, didn't Gerard see the one-armed man?
Yeah, in Wife Killer.
Yeah. Was that the first time
and
he saw
also
him?
I
can't remember. But you know what? They should have developed that there. And then also in the Ivy Maze, he saw the one-armed man.
Okay, right. Guys, can we just take a quick break here?
Sure.
Okay, we'll take a break. Talking Fugitive on KSAV.org, Share a Vision Radio. We'll be right back.
Take it from me, Mighty Mouse. When you're on the go all day, you don't always eat as good as you should. That's why I recommend Zestab. Mom, one Zestab gives a kid most of the vitamins he needs for a whole day. Excuse me. And kids, Zestabs are good to eat. They come in five delicious flavors. Want to see me eat one myself? Okay, I'll eat one myself. Cherry. Delicious, gang. Better than cheese.
Zestabs and Zestabs with iron. Endorsed by one of the strongest guys in the world.
Kids, if you send a name from a Zestab package and 50 cents to Mighty Mouse, Nutley, New Jersey, I'll send you a bigger-than-life-size poster of myself.
And just in time for Christmas, I think I'm going to send in my Zestab and my coupon and all my stuff and get one of those just in time for Christmas. What do you guys think?
Good idea.
Here we go. Back to Talking Fugitive.
All righty. Normally at this time, about halfway through our show, I discuss what's coming up in 2 weeks. What is coming up in 2 weeks and many weeks after that is a continuation of this discussion. We will simply stop when time runs out today, and we will pick it up in 2 weeks on the 16th of December, wherever we left off, even if it's in the middle of a sentence. But before we go on, I would like to mention that currently at the Fugitive Views and Reviews, on our board right there for the world to see, is something that has never been done before, and that's a continuation of The Judgment, a brand-new story written by none other than Kitty, called From Here on Out, and it deals with the characters after the series is over. I mean, it's one thing to say that Kimball may or may not get exonerated, but just because the story is over, lives are not over. In fact, they're just beginning. So Kitty has written a three-part story. Part one posted yesterday. Part two will be next Monday, and part three will be the following Monday. It's a great story. It's very interesting, and you'll never get anybody else to tell you what happened unless it's in your imagination. Excuse me. So I strongly urge anybody to go to our site and read Kitty's story, which will be there for the next 3 weeks. And then the last week of the year, we will repost a Christmas story she wrote a couple of years ago. That will be on the board, too. Right now, back to where we were a moment ago, and that is in the next scene. Is the lobby of the police headquarters building, where we see a stenographer named Jean Carlisle, apparently on her break, and she's getting some coffee out of the machine. She's sitting there with the same young guy, the same reporter that was upstairs talking to the cops. She sits with him, and all of a sudden she sees Gerard walk down the hallway, and she's jolted back to reality because she remembers him. Not quite all the way at first, but she recognizes him, and she and the reporter start discussing this, and eventually he tells her that, he lets her know that he was upstairs talking to the cops, and that apparently they're setting a trap for Kimball, and that's why they're making a big business about this one-armed vagrant who has been arrested, they're trying to trap him. Now, if there's ever a point in this episode where things begin to come unraveled, it's right here, except we don't know it yet, because at this moment, Jean Carlisle is in the story, but she appears to be what she says she is, an old family friend, and that's just fine. I don't have any problem with that. I personally don't like Diane Baker, who plays Jean Carlisle, but that's my problem. She's there, she's a family friend, and had she stayed that way, things might have looked different. Now, I don't want to get into what happens. That's later on. We'll discuss that in our next show or the show after that. Right now, she seems to be concerned. She's an old family friend. And she gets up and she goes over to a payphone where she calls Donna. And then we see Donna at home with her husband. And, Ken, you must have been shocked. It's the first time we've seen Donna in season 4.
Oh, yes, and she's in color.
Yeah, how about that? A colorful Donna.
What a novel idea. Have Donna in the last 2 episodes. Very brilliant writing on the writers, right? Boy.
A little too late.
You mentioned Jean Carlisle is in the police station or whatever there. You know, Gerard made a mistake. If he's going to set a trap, he needs to ask around and say, does anybody from Stafford, Indiana work here? You know, so he won't tip off.
That would have been
Richard
wise.
Kimble. So Gerard kind of blew it there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. What are
trap.
The chances of somebody from Stafford, Indiana working in Los Angeles?
I don't know. Seems to have happened.
I mean, I'm not going to fault Gerard on that. I mean, you know, he can't think of every scenario.
But, you know, that trap may have worked if it wasn't for Jean Carlisle.
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, anyway, so she goes and she calls Donna, and it's amazing that Jean Carlisle manages to remember just everything, because on the phone she talks to Donna and admits they haven't really spoken in at least 5 years, right, Kitty? Something about Christmas cards and that's
yeah,
it?
Yeah, they just have been exchanging Christmas cards.
So Jean tells her where she is, and that a one-armed man has been arrested, and Gerard is in on it, and apparently they're trying to trap Kimball to get him to come out of hiding and come over there. I don't know about this idea to trap him, because Kimball is not that stupid. He's too smart to do stuff like that. But, listen, it's been going on a long time, so, you know, it's interesting to see Gerard try anything, actually. So she tells Donna this, and then Donna says, Richard needs to know this. So she calls him up at the trucking company where he's working in Tucson. And that's unusual, because I had no idea that she was that able to get in touch with him. Kitty, we haven't seen that before. I always thought there were long periods where she didn't hear from him. Didn't you think that?
Yeah, although there was one episode, the one where, I believe it was the one with Captain Eckhart,
mm-hmm.
where I remember they made a comment about how, you know, Kimball does call his sister periodically.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
And, you know, and sometimes it's longer periods in between calls, but it sounds like from that episode, he does try to stay somewhat in touch.
Okay.
And, you know, and who knows, he might also send her letters periodically, too.
Okay, well, luckily for him, she knew this time. So she tells that, and then I believe that Donna calls the company only to find out that he's already quit the job, that he's on his way, apparently, to L.A., at least we assume that he is. So she calls Jean back. We don't see it, but she calls Jean back and tells her, that's what's happening, tells him where he was working. So, I just watched this a little while ago before we started the show, and things just happen so quickly, and there's really no explanation. And for instance, so Donna has told Jean the name of the trucking company where Kimball was working. And Jean then goes to the Los Angeles depot of that trucking company. Am I right so far, Kitty?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And she gets there, and amazingly, she immediately finds the one truck driver who just happened to give a ride to Kimball to L.A. Now, what are the odds of that? And will somebody tell me how they managed to get so quickly by truck from Tucson to L.A.? Is it really that close?
I don't think it's that close.
I don't know. Ken, you live in that general area. Is that close? Is it just down the corner to Tucson?
It's 8 hours.
Okay, well.
So, I mean, I suppose it's possible you could say maybe Kimball saw the newspaper really early in the morning, and so he'd been on the road all day by the time all of this was happening.
Don't you think she got awfully lucky to find that the first trucker happens to be the one, and that she's there at the exact moment he pulls in?
Yeah, that is quite a coincidence.
I mean, she pulls in, and he's there, and she goes up and says, "Did you give anybody a ride?" From Tucson, he says, "As a matter of fact, I did." And I'm sitting here thinking to myself, how lucky can you get? Because I would have thought you'd have to talk to every trucker there, and it would be a miracle and to find the one who actually gave a ride to this guy from Tucson, Arizona. It seems impossible. But, you know, when writers write, they just throw things out the window that they don't want to deal with. Don't ask me, and I won't tell you, and it's as simple as that. So this is one of many, many bits of suspension of disbelief. Get used to it, because there's going to be a lot of them. So he tells her that he left Kimball off at the produce market, where presumably he made a delivery. And in the next scene, Gene goes to the produce market, and here's another amazing coincidence. Kimball is still there. He's there, and he's making a phone call to the police department to find out what this what he can about this one-armed man. Of course, Gerard and the cops are already listening on the phone, but they don't know that Kimball is currently in L.A. Jean shows up in her car, and the cops are already there. They're buzzing around the produce terminal with wanted posters of Richard Kimball. And Kimball is, first he's in a phone booth, and he comes out of the phone booth, and he's standing right there. It's impossible to believe that the cops could not see him. Somehow, the cops don't see him. But she gets out of the car and immediately does. What do you think of that, Ken?
And he's wearing a sports jacket, too, right?
Yes.
I thought he was a trucker. And now
yeah, that's true. Jacket. You know, in the first scene where he was at work, he was actually wearing work clothes.
Yeah.
And then yet somehow he decided to change into a suit and tie for that long trek from Tucson to L.A.
Kitty, did you notice his hair? You know, very combed. You
well,
know,
his hair
like
always looks perfect, no matter what scenario he's in this show.
Hey, clean shaven.
Oh, he's always clean shaven.
Well, we put up with that from the beginning. I mean, this man, you know, there are people who go to work looking worse than that.
Oh.
And he's a fugitive, and he looks fabulous. So the cops are everywhere, and they fail to spot him. She sees him right away. It's really a miracle, especially considering the fact that she hasn't seen him in about 5 or 6 years. And she walks up to him, and of course he looks at her and goes, "Oh, I don't know you, you know, go away." And she says, I'm Ben Carlisle's daughter or whatever. And I talked to Donna. And Kimball's stuck, so he might as well go with her. He has nothing to lose. And he picks up a box of fruit or vegetables or something, puts it on his shoulder, and hides himself so they can get to her car. And they get to her car, and there comes number one of the dumbest scenes in the history of TV.
And we can learn about that.
Kimball's getting in the car. He's about to get away. And what does he do? He stops at the door, and he stares directly in the face of a police officer. Ken, this didn't really happen, did it?
Well, Ken, you're going to have to tell us about it next week, Ken, because time is up for today.
Okay.
Okay, gang, thank you very much. We'll talk to you in 2 weeks on December the 16th, Talking Fugitive on Sherevision Radio.
I've been a fool forgiving you each time that you've done me wrong. I've been a long time leaving, but I'll be a long time gone. I loved you so much, I loved you so much. Should have moved along. I've been a long time leaving, but I'll be a long time gone.
big legs on my Levi's.